after the other men were going out to their vehicles.
Sook, would you run by and check on Crystal when you get off?
Sure, but won't you be leaving work then?
I got to go over to Clarice and pick up some chain link. Crystal wants us to fence in some of the backyard for the baby, so it'll have a safe place to play.
I was surprised that Crystal was showing that much foresight and maternal instinct. Maybe having the baby would change her. I thought about Angela Kershaw and her little boy. I didn't want to count up how many girls younger than me had been married for years and had babies, or just had babies. I told myself envy was a sin, and I worked hard, smiling and nodding to everyone. Luckily, it was a busy day. During the afternoon lull, Sam asked me to help him take inventory in the storeroom while Holly covered the bar and the floor. We only had our two resident alcoholics to serve, so Holly was not going to have to work very hard. Since I was very nervous with Sam's BlackBerry, he entered the totals while I counted, and I had to climb up on a stepladder and then back down about 50 times, counting and dusting. We bought our cleaning supplies in bulk. We counted all those, too. Sam was just a counting fool today. The storeroom doesn't have any windows, so it got pretty warm in there while we were working. I was glad to get out of its stuffy confines when Sam was finally satisfied. I pulled a spiderweb out of his hair as I went by on my way to the bathroom, where I scrubbed my hands and carefully wiped my face, checking my ponytail, as best I could, for any spiderwebs I might have picked up myself. As I left the bar, I was so looking forward to getting in the shower that I almost turned left to go home. Just in time, I remembered I'd promised to look in on Crystal, so I turned right instead. Jason lived in my parents' house, and he'd kept it up very nicely. My brother was a house-proud kind of guy. He didn't mind spending his free time on painting, mowing, and basic repairs, a side of him I always found a bit surprising. He'd recently painted the outside a buff color and the trim a glowing white, and the little house looked very spruce. There was a driveway that made a U-shape in front. He'd added a branch that led to the porte cochere in back of the house, but I pulled up to the front steps. I stuffed my car keys in my pocket and crossed the porch. I turned the knob because I planned on sticking my head in the door and calling to Crystal, since I was family. The front door was unlocked, as most front doors were during the daytime. The family room was empty.
"Hey, Crystal, it's Sookie," I called, though I tried to keep my voice subdued so I wouldn't startle her if she were napping.
I heard a muffled sound, a moan. It came from the biggest bedroom, the one my parents had used, which lay across the family room and to my right. "Oh, shit, she's miscarrying again," I thought, and dashed to the closed door. I flung it open so hard it bounced off the wall, but I didn't pay a bit of attention, because bouncing on the bed were Crystal and Dove Beck. I was so shocked, so angry, and so distraught that as they stopped what they were doing and stared up at me, I said the worst thing I could think of.
"No wonder you lose all your babies."
I spun on my heel and marched out of the house. I was so outraged I couldn't even get in the car. It was really unfortunate that Calvin pulled up behind me and leaped from his truck almost before it stopped.
"My God, what's wrong?" he said. "Is Crystal okay?"
"Why don't you ask her that?"
I said nastily, and climbed into my car, only to sit there shaken. Calvin ran into the house as if he had to put out a fire, and I guess that was about the size of it.
"Jason, damn it!"
I yelled, thumping my fist on my steering wheel. I should have taken the time to listen to Jason's brain. He'd known good and well that since he had business in Clarice, Dove and Crystal would probably take the opportunity to have a tryst. He'd planned on me being dutiful and dropping by. It was just too big a coincidence that Calvin had shown up. He must have also told Calvin to check on Crystal. So there was no deniability and no chance of hushing this up, not since Calvin and I both knew. I had been right to worry about the terms of the marriage, and now I had something entirely new to worry about. Plus, I was ashamed. I was ashamed of the behavior of everyone involved. In my code of conduct, which doesn't really make me a very good Christian at all, what single people do in caring relationships is their own business. Even in a more casual relationship, well, if the people respect one another, okay. But A couple who's promised to be faithful, who's pledged that publicly, are governed by a whole different set of rules in my world. Not in Crystal's world, or Dove's world, apparently. Calvin came back down the steps looking years older than he had when he'd bounded up them. He stopped by my car. He wore an expression twin to mine. Disillusion, disappointment, disgust. Lots of disses there.
I'll be in touch, he said. We got to have the ceremony now.
Crystal came out on the porch wrapped in a leopard print bathrobe, and rather than endure her speaking to me, I started the car and left as quickly as I could. I drove home in a daze. When I came in the back door, Amelia was chopping up something on the old cutting board, the one that had survived the fire with only scorch marks. She turned to speak to me and had opened her mouth when she saw my face. I shook my head at her, warning her not to talk, and I went straight into my room. This would have been a good day for me to be living by myself again. I sat in my room in the little chair in the corner, the one that had seated so many visitors lately. Bob was curled up in a ball on my bed, a place he was expressly forbidden to sleep. Someone had opened my door during the day. I thought about chewing Amelia out about that, then discarded the idea when I saw a pile of clean and folded underwear lying on top of my dresser. Bob, I said, and the cat unfolded and leaped to his feet in one fluid movement. He stood on my bed, staring at me with wide golden eyes. Get the hell out of here, I said. With immense dignity, Bob leaped down from the bed and stalked to the door. I opened it a few inches and he went out, managing to leave the impression that he was doing this of his own free will. I shut the door behind him. I love cats. I just wanted to be by myself. The phone rang, and I stood up to answer it.
Tomorrow night, Calvin said. Wear something comfortable. 7 o'clock.
He sounded sad and tired. Okay, I said, and we both hung up. I sat there a while longer. Whatever this ceremony consisted of, did I have to be a participant?
Yeah, I did.
Unlike Crystal, I kept my promises. I'd had to stand up for Jason at his wedding, as his closest relative, as a surrogate, to take his punishment if he was unfaithful to his new wife. Calvin had stood up for Crystal, and now look what we'd come to. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew it was going to be awful. Though the Werepanthers understood the necessity for breeding each available pure male panther to each available pure female panther, the only way to produce purebred baby panthers, they also believed once the breeding had been given a chance, any partnerships formed should be monogamous. If you didn't want to take that vow, you didn't form a partnership or marry. This was the way they ran their community. Crystal would have absorbed these rules from birth, and Jason had learned them from Calvin before the wedding. Jason didn't call, and I was glad. I wondered what was happening at his house, but only in a dull kind of way. When had Crystal met Dove Beck? Did Dove's wife know about this? I wasn't surprised that Crystal had cheated on Jason, but I was a little astonished at her choice. I decided that Crystal had wanted to make her betrayal as emphatic as it could possibly be. She was saying, I'll have sex with someone else while I'm carrying your child, and he'll be older than you, and a different race from you, and he'll even work for you, twisting the knife in deeper with every layer. If this was retaliation for the damn cheeseburger, I'd say she'd gotten a steak-size vengeance. Because I didn't want to seem like I was sulking, I came out for supper, which was lowly and comforting tuna noodle casserole with peas and onions. After stacking the dishes for Octavia to take care of, I retreated back to my room. The two witches were practically tiptoeing up and down the hall because they were so anxious not to disturb me, though, of course, they were dying to ask what the problem was. But they didn't. God bless them. I really couldn't have explained. I was too mortified. I said about a million prayers before I went to sleep that night, but none of them ended up making me feel any better. I went to work the next day because I had to. Staying home wouldn't have made me feel any better. I was profoundly glad Jason didn't come into Merlot's, because I would have thrown a mug at him if he had. Sam eyed me carefully several times, and finally he drew me behind the bar with him.
"Tell me what's happening," he said.
Tears flooded my eyes, and I was within an ace of making a real scene. I squatted down hastily, as if I'd dropped something on the floor, and said, "Sam, please don't ask me. I'm too upset to talk about it." Suddenly, I realized it would be a big comfort to tell Sam, but I just couldn't, not in the crowded bar.
"Hey, you know I'm here if you need me."
His face was serious. He patted my shoulder. I was so lucky to have him for a boss. His gesture reminded me that I had lots of friends who would not dishonor themselves as Crystal had done. Jason had dishonored himself, too, by forcing Calvin and me to witness her cheap betrayal. I had so many friends who would not do such a thing. It was a trick of fate that the one who would was my own brother. This thought made me feel better and stronger. I actually had a backbone by the time I got home. No one else was there. I hesitated, wondering whether I should call Tara or beg Sam to take an hour off, or even call Bill to go with me to Hotshot, but that was just weakness talking. This was something I had to do by myself. Calvin had warned me to wear something comfortable and not to dress up, and my Merlot's outfit was certainly both those things. But it seemed wrong to wear my work clothes to an event like this. There might be blood. I didn't know what to anticipate. I pulled on yoga pants and an old gray sweatshirt. I made sure my hair was pulled back. I looked like I was dressed to clean out my closets. On the drive to Hotshot, I turned up the radio and sang at the top of my lungs to keep myself from thinking. I harmonized with Evanescence and agreed with the Dixie Chicks that I wasn't going to back down, a good spine-stiffening song to listen to. I reached Hotshot well before 7. I'd last been out here at Jason and Crystal's wedding, where I danced with Quinn. That visit of Quinn's had been the only time he and I had been intimate. In hindsight, I regretted having taken that step. It had been a mistake. I'd been banking on a future that never came to pass. I'd jumped the gun. I hoped I'd never make that mistake again. I parked, as I had the night of Jason's wedding, by the side of the road. There weren't nearly as many cars here tonight as there had been then, when many plain human people had been guests, but there were a few extra vehicles. I recognized Jason's truck. The others belonged to the few were-panthers who didn't live in Hotshot. A little crowd had already assembled in the backyard of Calvin's house. People made way for me until I'd gotten to the center of the gathering and found Crystal, Jason, and Calvin. I saw some familiar faces. A middle-aged panther named Mary Elizabeth nodded to me. I saw her daughter nearby. The girl, whose name I couldn't remember, was by no means the only underage observer. I got that creepy feeling that raised the hairs on my arms, the way I did every time I tried to picture everyday life in Hotshot. Calvin was staring down at his boots, and he didn't look up. Jason didn't meet my eyes either. Only Crystal was upright and defiant, her dark eyes catching mine, daring me to stare her down. I did dare, and after a moment, she dropped her gaze to somewhere in the middle distance. Mary Elizabeth had a tattered old book in her hand, and she opened it to a page she'd marked with a torn piece of newspaper. The community seemed to still and settle. This was the purpose for which they'd assembled. "We people of the Fang and Claw are here because one of us broke her vows," Mary Elizabeth said. "At the marriage of Crystal and Jason, were-panthers of this community, they each promised to remain true to their marriage vows, both in the way of the cat and the way of the human. Crystal's surrogate was her uncle Calvin, and Jason's was his sister, Sookie." I was aware of the eyes of all the assembled community moving from Calvin to me. A lot of those eyes were golden yellow. Inbreeding in Hotshot had produced some slightly alarming results. "Now that Crystal has broken her vows, a fact witnessed by the surrogates, Her uncle has offered to take the punishment since Crystal is pregnant.
This was going to be even nastier than I'd suspected.
Since Calvin takes Crystal's place, Sookie, do you choose to take Jason's place?
Oh, crap. I looked at Calvin, and I knew my whole face was asking him if there was any way out of this, and his whole face told me no. He actually looked sorry for me. I would never forgive my brother or Crystal for this.
Sookie, Mary Elizabeth prompted.
What would I have to do? I said, and if I sounded sullen and grudging and angry, I thought I had a good reason. Mary Elizabeth opened the book again and read the answer.
We exist by our wits and our claws, and if faith is broken, a claw is broken, she said.
I stared at her, trying to make sense of that.
Either you or Jason has to break Calvin's finger, she said simply. In fact, since Crystal broke the faith completely, you have to break two at least. More would be better. Jason gets to pick, I guess.
More would be better? Jesus Christ, Shepherd of Judea! I tried to be dispassionate. Who could cause the most damage to my friend Calvin? My brother, no doubt about it. If I was a true friend to Calvin, I would do this. Could I bring myself to? And then it was taken out of my hands. Jason said,
I didn't think it would happen this way, Sookie.
He sounded simultaneously angry, confused, and defensive.
If Calvin stands in for Crystal, I want Sookie to stand in for me, he told Mary Elizabeth.
I never thought I could hate my own brother, but at that moment, I found out it was possible.
So be it, said Mary Elizabeth.
I tried to boost myself up mentally. After all, this wasn't maybe quite as bad as I'd anticipated. I'd pictured Calvin being whipped or having to whip Crystal. Or we might have had to do some awful thing involving knives. That would have been way worse. I tried to believe this might not be so bad right up until the time two of the males carried out a pair of concrete blocks and put them on top of the picnic table. And then Mary Elizabeth produced a brick. She held it out to me. I began to shake my head involuntarily because I felt a heavy twinge in my stomach. Nausea did flip-flops in my belly. Looking at the common red brick, I began to have an idea what this was going to cost me. Calvin stepped forward and took my hand. He leaned over to talk very close to my ear.
Darling, he said, you have to do this. I accepted this when I stood up for her when she married, and I knew what she was, and you know Jason. This might easily have been the other way around. I might be about to do this to you, and you don't heal as well. This is better, and it has to be. Our people require this.
He straightened and looked me right in the eyes. His own were golden, utterly strange, and quite steady. I pinched my lips together, and I made myself nod. Calvin gave me a bracing look and took his place by the table. He put his hand on the concrete blocks. With no further ado, Mary Elizabeth handed me the brick. The rest of the Panthers waited patiently for me to perform the punishment. The vampires would have dressed this all up with a special wardrobe and probably an extra special fancy brick from an old temple or something, but not the Panthers. It was just a damn brick. I held it with both hands gripping one long side. After I'd looked at it for a long minute, I said to Jason,
I don't want to talk to you again. Ever.
I faced Crystal.
I hope you enjoyed it, bitch, I said.
And I turned as quick as I could and brought the brick down on Calvin's hand. Chapter 19. Amelia and Octavia hovered around for 2 days before they decided leaving me alone was the best policy. Reading their anxious thoughts just made me surlier, because I didn't want to accept comfort. I should suffer for what I'd done,
and that meant I couldn't accept any easing of my misery. So I gloomed and sulked and brooded and rained my grim mood all over my house. My brother came into the bar once, and I turned my back on him. Dove Beck didn't choose to drink at Merlot's, which was a good thing, though he was the least guilty of the bunch as far as I was concerned, though that didn't make him any clean Jean. When Alcee Beck came in, it was clear his brother had confided in him, because Alcee looked even angrier than usual, and he met my eyes every chance he got, just to let me know he was my equal. Thank God Calvin didn't show. I couldn't have stood it. I heard enough talk around the bar from his co-workers at Norcross about the accident he'd had while he was working on his truck at home. Most unexpectedly, on the third night, Eric walked into Merlot's. I took one look at him, and suddenly my throat seemed to ease, and I felt tears well up in my eyes. But Eric walked through as though he owned the place, and he went into the hall to Sam's office. Moments later, Sam stuck his head out and beckoned to me. After I walked in, I didn't expect Sam to shut the office door. "What's wrong?" Sam asked me. He'd been trying to find out for days, and I'd been fending off his well-meant queries. Eric was standing to one side, his arms crossed over his chest. He made a gesture with one hand that said,
"Tell us, we're waiting."
Despite his brusqueness, his presence relaxed the big knot inside me, the one that had kept the words locked in my stomach. "I broke Calvin Norris's hand into bits," I said, "with a brick."
"Then he was..."
"He stood up for your sister-in-law at the wedding," Sam said, figuring it out quickly.
Eric looked blank. The vampires know something about the were-animals, they have to, but the vamps think they are far superior, so they don't make an effort to learn specifics about the rituals and rhythms of being a were.
"She had to break his hand, which represents his claws in panther form," Sam explained impatiently. "She stood up for Jason."
And then Sam and Eric exchanged a look that scared me in its complete agreement. Neither of them liked Jason one little bit. Sam looked from me to Eric, as if he expected Eric to do something to make me feel better.
"I don't belong to him," I said sharply, since all of this was making me feel handled in a major way. "Did you think Eric coming would make me feel all happy and carefree?"
"No," Sam said, sounding a little angry himself. "But I hoped it would help you talk about whatever was wrong."
"What's wrong?" I said very quietly.
"Okay. What's wrong is that my brother arranged for Calvin and me to check on Crystal, who's about 4 months pregnant, and he fixed it so we'd get there at about the same time. And when we checked, we found Crystal in bed with Dove Beck, as Jason knew we would."
Eric said,
"And for this, you had to break the werepanther's fingers?"
He might have been asking if I'd had to wear chicken bones and turn around 3 times. It was so obvious he was inquiring into the quaint customs of a primitive tribe.
"Yes, Eric, that's what I had to do," I said grimly. "I had to break my friend's fingers with a brick in front of a crowd."
For the first time, Eric seemed to realize that he'd taken the wrong approach. Sam was looking at him in total exasperation.
"And I thought you'd be such a big help," he said.
"I have a few things going in Shreveport,"
Eric answered with a shade of defensiveness,
"including hosting the new king."
Sam muttered something that sounded suspiciously like, "Fucking vampires." This was totally unfair. I'd expected tons of sympathy when I finally confessed the reason for my bad mood, but now Sam and Eric were so wrapped up in being irritated with each other that neither one of them was giving me a moment's thought.
"Well, thanks, guys," I said. "This has been a lot of fun. Eric, big help there. I appreciate the kind words."
And I left in what my grandmother called high dudgeon. I stomped back out into the bar and waited on tables so grimly that some people were scared to call me over to order more drinks. I decided to clean the surfaces behind the bar, because Sam was still in his office with Eric, though possibly Eric had left out the back door. I scrubbed and polished and pulled some beers for Holly, and I straightened everything so meticulously that Sam might have a wee problem finding things, just for a week or two. Then Sam came out to take his place, looked at the counter in mute displeasure, and jerked his head to indicate I should get the hell out from behind the bar. My bad mood was catching. You know how it is sometimes, when someone really tries to cheer you up, when you just decide that, by golly, nothing in the world is going to make you feel better? Sam had thrown Eric at me like he was throwing a happy pill, yet he was aggravated that I hadn't swallowed it. Instead of being grateful that Sam was fond enough of me to call Eric, I was mad at him for his assumption. I was in a totally black mood. Quinn was gone. I'd banished him. Stupid mistake or wise decision? Verdict still out. Lots of wares were dead in Shreveport because of Priscilla, and I'd watched some of them die. Believe me, that sticks with you. More than a few vampires were dead, too, including some I'd known fairly well. My brother was a devious, manipulative bastard. My great-grandfather wasn't ever going to take me fishing. Okay, now I was getting silly. Suddenly, I smiled, because I was picturing the Prince of the Fairies in old denim overalls and a Bon Ton Hawks baseball cap, carrying a can of worms and a couple of fishing poles. I caught Sam's eye as I cleared a table of plates. I winked at him. He turned away, shaking his head, but I caught a hint of a smile at the corners of his mouth. And just like that, my bad mood was officially over. My common sense kicked in. There was no point in lashing myself over the hotshot incident any longer. I'd had to do what I'd had to do. Calvin understood that better than I did. My brother was an asshole, and Crystal was a whore. These were facts I had to deal with. Granted, they were both unhappy people who were acting out because they were married to the wrong spouse, but they were also both chronologically adults, and I couldn't fix their marriage any more than I'd been able to prevent it. The Wares had dealt with their own problems in their own way, and I'd done my best to help them. Vampires? Ditto. Sort of. Okay. Not all better, but enough better. When I got off work, I wasn't completely annoyed to find Eric waiting by my car. He seemed to be enjoying the night, standing all by himself in the cold. I was shivering myself because I hadn't brought a heavy jacket. My windbreaker wasn't enough.
It's been nice to be by myself for a while, Eric said unexpectedly.
I guess at Fantasia you're always surrounded, I said.
Always surrounded by people wanting things, he said.
But you enjoy that, right? Being the big kahuna? Eric looked like he was mulling that over.
Yes, I like that. I like being the boss. I don't like being overseen. Is that a word? I'll be glad when Felipe de Castro and his minion Sandy take their departure. Victor will stay to take over New Orleans.
Eric was sharing. This was almost unprecedented. This was like a normal give and take between equals. What's the new king like? Cold as I was, I couldn't resist keeping the conversation going.
He's handsome, ruthless, and clever, Eric said.
Like you.
I could have slapped myself.
Eric nodded after a moment.
But more so, Eric said grimly. I'll have to keep very alert to stay ahead of him.
How gratifying to hear you say so,
said an accented voice. This was definitely an oh shit moment, an OSM as I called them to myself. A gorgeous man stepped out from the trees, and I blinked as I took him in. As Eric bowed, I scanned Felipe de Castro from his gleaming shoes to his bold face. As I bowed too, belatedly, I realized that Eric hadn't been exaggerating when he said the new king was handsome. Felipe de Castro was a Latin male who threw Jimmy Smits into the shade, and I am a big admirer of Mr. Smits. Though perhaps 5'10" or so, Castro carried himself with such importance and straight posture that you couldn't think of him as short. Rather, he made other men look too tall. His dark, thick hair was clipped close to his head, and he had a mustache and chin strip. He had caramel skin and dark eyes, strong arched eyebrows, a bold nose. The king wore a cape. No kidding, a real full-length black cape. I'll tell you how impressive he was. I didn't even think of giggling. Other than the cape, he seemed dressed for a night that might include flamenco dancing, with a white shirt, black vest, and black dress slacks. One of Castro's ears was pierced, and there was a dark stone in it. The overhead security light didn't let me get a better idea of what it might be. Ruby? Emerald? I had straightened up, and I was staring again. But when I glanced at Eric, I saw he was still bowing. Uh-oh. Well, I wasn't one of his subjects, and I wasn't going to do that again. It had gone against my Americanness to do it once. "Hi, I'm Sookie Stackhouse," I said, since the silence was getting awkward. I automatically held out my hand, remembered Vamps didn't shake, and snatched it back. "Excuse me," I said. The king inclined his head.
"Miss Stackhouse," he said, his accent strumming my name delightfully.
"Yes, sir. I'm sorry to meet you and run, but it's really cold out here, and I need to get home." I beamed at him, my lunatic beam I give when I'm really nervous. "Goodbye, Eric," I babbled, and stood on tiptoe to kiss him on the cheek. "Give me a call when you have a minute, unless you need me to stay for some crazy reason."
"No, lover. You need to go home and get into the warmth," Eric said, clasping both my hands in his. "I'll call you when my work permits."
When he let go of me, I did an awkward sort of dip in the king's direction, American, not used to bowing, and hopped into my car before either vampire could change his mind about my departure. I felt like a coward, a very relieved coward, as I backed out of my space and drove out of the parking lot. But I was already debating the wisdom of my departure as I turned onto Hummingbird Road. I was worried about Eric. This was a fairly new phenomenon, one that made me very uneasy, and it had started the night of the coup. Worrying about Eric was like worrying about the well-being of a rock or a tornado. When had I ever had to worry about him before? He was one of the most powerful vampires I'd ever met. But Sophie Anne had been even more powerful and protected by the huge warrior Siebert, and look what had happened to her. I felt abruptly, acutely, miserable. What was wrong with me? I had a terrible idea. Maybe I was worried simply because Eric was worried. Miserable because Eric was miserable. Could I receive his emotions this strongly and from this great a distance? Should I turn around and find out what was happening? If the king was being cruel to Eric, I couldn't possibly be of any assistance. I had to pull over to the side of the road. I couldn't drive anymore. I'd never had a panic attack, but I thought I was having one now. I was paralyzed with indecision. Again, not one of my usual characteristics. Struggling with myself, trying to think clearly, I realized I had to turn back whether I wanted to or not. It was an obligation I couldn't ignore, not because I was bonded to Eric, but because I liked him. I turned the wheel and did a U-turn in the middle of Hummingbird Road. Since I'd only seen two cars since I'd left the bar, the maneuver was no big traffic violation. I drove back a lot faster than I'd left, and when I got to Merlot's, I found that the customer parking lot was completely empty. I parked in front and pulled my old softball bat out from under the seat. My grandmother had given it to me for my 16th birthday. It was a very good bat, though it had seen better days. I crept around the building, taking advantage of the bushes that grew at the foundation for cover. Nandinas. I hate nandinas. They're straggly and ugly and leggy, and I'm allergic to them. Though I was covered with a windbreaker, pants, and socks, the minute I began threading my way among the plants, my nose began to run. I peeked around the corner very cautiously. I was so shocked I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Siebert, the queen's bodyguard, had not been killed in the coup. No, sirree, he was still among the undead, and he was here in the Merlot's parking lot, and he was having a lot of fun with the new king, Felipe de Castro, and with Eric, and with Sam, who'd been swept up in the net, probably by simply leaving his bar to walk to his trailer. I took a deep breath, a deep but silent breath, and made myself analyze what I was seeing. Seabert was a mountain of a man, and he'd been the queen's muscle for centuries. His brother, Waybert, had died in the queen's service, and I was sure Seabert had been a target of the Nevada vamps. They'd left their mark on him. Vampires heal fast, but Seabert had been wounded badly enough that even days after he'd fought, he was still visibly damaged. There was a huge cut across his forehead and a horrible-looking mark just above where I thought his heart would be. His clothes were ripped and stained and filthy. Maybe the Nevada vamps thought he'd disintegrated when, in fact, he'd managed to get away and hide. Not important, I told myself. The important part was that he'd succeeded in binding both Eric and Felipe de Castro with silver chains. How? Not important, I told myself again. Maybe this tendency to mentally wander was coming from Eric, who was looking much more battered than the king. Of course, Seabert would see Eric as a traitor. Eric was bleeding from the head, and his arm was clearly broken. Castro was bleeding sluggishly from the mouth, so Seabert had maybe stomped on him. Eric and Castro were both lying on the ground, and in the harsh security light, they both looked whiter than snow. Sam had been tied to the bumper of his own truck somehow, and he wasn't damaged at all, at least so far. Thank God. I tried to figure out how I could conquer Seabert with my aluminum softball bat, but I didn't come up with any good ideas. If I rushed him, he'd just laugh. Even as grievously wounded as he was still a vampire, and I was no match for him unless I had a great idea. So I watched, and I waited. But in the end, I couldn't stand to see him hurting Eric anymore. Believe me, when a vampire kicks you, you get plenty hurt. Plus, Seabert was having a great time with the big knife he had brought. The biggest weapon at my disposal? Okay, that would be my car. I felt a little pang of regret because it was the best car I'd ever had, and Tara had sold it to me for $1 when she'd gotten a newer one. But it was the only thing I could think of that would make a dent in Seabert. So, back I crept, praying that Seabert would be so absorbed in his torture that he wouldn't notice the sound of the car door. I laid my head on the steering wheel and thought as hard as I've ever thought. I considered the parking lot and its topography, and I thought about the location of the bound vampires. And I took a deep breath and turned the key. I started around the building, wishing my car could creep through the damn nandina bushes like I had, and I swung wide to allow room to charge, and my lights caught Seabert, and I hit the accelerator and went straight at him. He tried to get out of the way, but he was none too bright, and I'd caught him with his pants down. Literally, I really didn't like to think about his next torture plan, and I hit him very hard, and up he bounced to land on the roof of the car with a huge thud. I screamed and braked because this was as far as my plan had gone. He slid down the back of the car, leaving a horrible sheet of dark blood, and disappeared from view. Scared he'd pop up in the rearview mirror, I threw the car into reverse and hit the pedal again. Bump, bump. I yanked the gear stick into park and leaped out, bat in hand, to find Seabert's legs and most of his torso were wedged under the car. I dashed over to Eric and began fumbling with the silver chain, while he stared at me with his eyes wide. Castro was cursing in Spanish, fluently and fluidly, and Sam was saying, "Hurry, Suki, hurry!" which really didn't help my powers of concentration. I gave up on the damn chains and got the big knife and cut Sam free so he could help. The knife came close enough to his skin to make him yelp a time or two, but I was really doing the best I could, and he didn't bleed. To give him credit, he made it over to Castro in record time and began freeing him while I ran back to Eric, laying the knife on the ground beside us as I worked. Now that I had at least one ally who had the use of his hands and legs, I was able to concentrate, and I got Eric's legs unbound. At least now he could run away. I guess that was my thinking. And then, more slowly, his arms and hands. The silver had been wound around him many times, and Seabert had made sure it touched Eric's hands. They looked ghastly. Castro had suffered even more from the chains because Seabert had divested him of his beautiful cape and most of his shirt. I was unwinding the last strand when Eric shoved me as hard as he could, grabbed the knife, and leaped to his feet so swiftly I saw only a blur. Then he was on Seabert, who had actually lifted the car to release his own trapped legs. He'd begun dragging himself out from under, and in another minute He would have been ambulatory. Did I mention it was a big knife? And it must have been sharp, too, because Eric landed by Siebert, said, "Go to your maker," and cut off the warrior vampire's head. "Oh," I said shakily, and sat down abruptly on the cold parking lot gravel. "Oh, wow." We all remained where we were, panting for a good 5 minutes. Then Sam straightened up from the side of Felipe de Castro and offered him a hand. The vampire took it, and when he was upright, he introduced himself to Sam, who automatically introduced himself right back.
"Miss Stackhouse," the king said, "I am in your debt."
Damn straight. "It's okay," I said in a voice that wasn't nearly as level as it should be.
"Thank you," he said. "If your car is too damaged to repair, I'll be very glad to buy you another one."
"Oh, thanks," I said with absolute sincerity as I stood up. "I'll try to drive home tonight. I don't know how I can explain the damage. Do you think the body shop would believe I ran over an alligator?" That did happen occasionally. Was it weird that I was worried about the car insurance?
"Dawson would look at it for you," Sam said.
His voice was as odd as mine. He, too, had thought he was going to die.
"I know he's a motorcycle repairman, but I bet he could fix your car. He works on his own all the time."
"Do what is necessary," said Castro grandly.
"I will pay." "Eric, would you care to explain what just happened?"
His voice was considerably more acerbic.
"You should ask your crew to explain," Eric retorted, with some justification. "Didn't they tell you Siebert, the queen's bodyguard, was dead? Yet here he is."
"An excellent point."
Castro looked down at the crumbling body.
"So that was the legendary Siebert. He's gone to join his brother, Weybert."
He sounded quite pleased. I hadn't known the brothers were famous among the vampires, but they'd certainly been unique. Their mountainous physiques, their broken and primitive English, their utter devotion to the woman who'd turned them centuries before. Sure, any right-minded vampire would love that story. I sagged where I stood, and Eric, moving faster than I could see, picked me up. It was a very Scarlet and Rhett moment, spoiled only by the fact that there were two other guys there, we were in a humdrum parking lot, and I was unhappy about the damage to my car. Plus, not a little shocked.
"How'd he get the jump on three strong guys like you all?" I asked. I didn't worry about Eric holding me. It made me feel tiny, not a feeling I got to enjoy all that often. There was a moment of general embarrassment.
"I was standing with my back to the woods," Castro explained.
"He had the chains arranged for throwing. Your word is almost the same. Lasso."
"Lasso," Sam said.
"Ah, lasso. The first one he threw around me, and of course the shock was great. Before Eric could land on him, he had Eric as well. The pain from the silver. Very quickly we were bound. When this one," he nodded toward Sam, "came to our aid, Siebert knocked him unconscious and got rope from the back of Sam's truck and tied him up."
"We were too involved in our discussion to be wary," Eric said.
He sounded pretty grim, and I didn't blame him, but I decided to keep my mouth shut.
"Ironic, eh? That we needed a human girl to rescue us,"
the king said blithely, the very idea that I decided not to voice.
"Yes, very amusing," Eric said in a dreadfully unamused voice. "Why did you return, Sookie?"
"I felt your, anger at being attacked." For anger, read despair. The new king looked very interested.
"A blood bond. How interesting."
"No, not really," I said. "Sam, I wonder if you'd mind driving me home. I don't know where you gentlemen left your cars, or if you flew. I do wonder how Siebert knew where to find you." Felipe de Castro and Eric shared almost identical expressions of deep thought.
"We'll find out,"
Eric said, and set me down.
"And then heads are going to roll."
Eric was good at setting heads to rolling. It was one of his favorite things. I was willing to put my money on Castro sharing that predilection, because the king was looking positively gleeful in anticipation. Sam fished his keys out of his pocket without a word, and I climbed into the truck with him. We left the two vampires involved in a deep conversation. Siebert's corpse, still partially under my poor car, was almost gone, leaving a dark, greasy residue on the gravel of the parking lot. The good thing about vampires, no corpse disposal.
I'll call Dawson tonight,
Sam said unexpectedly. Oh, Sam, thank you, I said. I'm so glad you were there.
It's the parking lot of my bar, he said,
and it might have been my own guilty reaction, but I thought I detected some reproach. I suddenly came to the full realization that Sam had walked into a situation in his own backyard, a situation he had no stake or interest in, and that he'd almost died as a result. And why had Eric been in the parking lot back of Merlot's? To talk to me. And then Felipe de Castro had followed to talk to Eric, though I wasn't sure why. But the point was, them being there at all was my fault. Oh, Sam, I said, almost in tears. I'm so sorry. I didn't know Eric would wait for me, and I sure didn't know the king would follow him. I still don't know why he was there. I'm so sorry, I said again. I would say it 100 times if it would take that tone out of Sam's voice.
It's not your fault, he said. I asked Eric to come here in the first place. It's their fault. I don't know how we can pry you loose from them.
This was bad, but somehow you're not taking it like I thought you would.
I just want to be left in peace, he said unexpectedly. I don't want to get involved in supernatural politics. I don't want to have to take sides and wear shit. I'm not a wear, I'm a shapeshifter, and shifters don't organize. We're too different. I hate vampire politics even more than wear politics.
You're mad at me.
No!
He seemed to be struggling with what he wanted to say.
I don't want that for you either. Weren't you happier before?
You mean before I knew any vampires? Before I knew about the rest of the world that lies outside the boundaries? Sam nodded. In some ways. It was nice to have a clear path before me, I said. I do get really sick of the politics and the battles. But my life wasn't any prize, Sam. Every day was a struggle just to act like I was a regular human, like I didn't know all the things I know about other humans. The cheating and infidelity, the little acts of dishonesty, the unkindness, the really severe judgments people pass on each other, their lack of charity. When you know all that, it's hard to keep going sometimes. Knowing about the supernatural world puts all that in a different perspective. I don't know why. People aren't any better or worse than the supernaturals, but they're not all there is, either.
I guess I understand,
Sam said, though he sounded a little doubtful. Plus, I said very quietly, it's nice to be valued for the very thing that makes regular people think I'm just a crazy girl.
Definitely understand that,
Sam said,
but there's a price.
Oh, no doubt about it.
You willing to pay?
So far. We chugged up my driveway. No lights on. The witchy duo had gone to bed, or else they were out partying or casting spells.
In the morning, I'll call Dawson, Sam said. He'll check out your car, make sure you can drive it, or he'll get it towed to his place. Think you can get a ride to work?
I'm sure I can, I said. Amelia can bring me in. Sam walked me to the back door like he was bringing me home from a date. The porch light was on, which was thoughtful of Amelia. Sam put his arms around me, which was a surprise, and then he just snugged his head in close to mine, and we stood there enjoying each other's warmth for a long moment.
We survived the werewar,
he said.
You made it through the vampire coup. Now we live through the attack of the berserk bodyguard. I hope we keep up our record.
Now you're scaring me, I said, as I remembered all the other things I'd survived. I should be dead, no doubt about it. His warm lips brushed my cheek.
Maybe that's a good thing,
he said, and turned to go back to his truck. I watched him climb in and reverse, and then I unlocked the back door and went to my room. After all the adrenaline and the fear and the accelerated pace of life and death in the parking lot of Merlot's, my own room seemed very quiet and clean and secure. I'd done my best to kill someone tonight. It was only by chance Siebert had survived my attempt at vehicular homicide, twice. I couldn't help but notice that I wasn't feeling remorseful. This was surely a flaw, but at the moment, I just didn't care. There were definitely parts of my character I didn't approve of, and maybe from time to time I had moments when I didn't like myself much. But I got through each day as it came to me, and so far, I'd survived everything life had thrown at me. I could only hope that the survival was worth the price I'd paid. Chapter 20. To my relief, I woke up in an empty house. Neither Amelia's nor Octavia's throbbing heads were under my roof. I lay in bed and reveled in the knowledge. Maybe the next time I had a whole day off, I could spend it completely alone. That didn't seem a likely occurrence, but a girl can dream. After I planned my day, call Sam to find out about my car, pay some bills, go to work, I got into the shower and really scrubbed. I used as much hot water as I wanted. I painted my toenails and my fingernails, and I pulled on a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt and went in to make some coffee. The kitchen was spanking clean. God bless Amelia. The coffee was great, the toast delicious, spread with blueberry jam. Even my taste buds were happy. After I cleaned up from breakfast, I was practically singing with the pleasure of solitude. I went back to my room to make my bed and put on my makeup. Of course, that was when the knock came at the back door, nearly making me jump out of my skin. I stepped into some shoes and went to answer it. Trey Dawson was there, and he was smiling.
Sookie, your car's doing fine, he said. I had to do a little replacing here and there, and it's the first time I ever had to scrape vampire ash off an undercarriage, but you're good to go.
Oh, thanks. Can you come in?
Just for a minute, he said. You got a Coke in the refrigerator?
I sure do. I brought him a Coke, asked if he wanted some cookies or a peanut butter sandwich to go with it, and when he turned that down, I excused myself to finish my makeup. I'd figured Dawson would run me to the car, but he'd driven it over to my place, as it turned out, so I'd need to give him a ride instead. I had my checkbook out and my pen in hand when I sat at the table opposite the big man and asked him how much I owed him.
Not a dime, Dawson said. The new guy paid for it.
The new king?
Yeah, he called me in the middle of the night last night, told me the story, more or less, and asked me if I could look at the car first thing in the morning. I was awake when he called, so I didn't make me know never mind. I got over to Merlot's this morning, told Sam he wasted a phone call since I already knew all about it. I followed him while he drove the car out to my place, and we put it up on the rack and had a good look.
This was a long speech for Dawson. I put my checkbook back in my purse and listened, silently asking him if he wanted more Coke by pointing at his glass. He shook his head, letting me know he was satisfied.
We had to tighten up a few things, replace your windshield fluid reservoir. I knew just where another car like yours was at Rusty's Salvage, and it didn't take no time to do the job.
I could only thank him again. I drove Dawson out to his repair shop. Since the last time I'd driven by, he'd trimmed up the front yard of his home, a modest but tidy frame house that stood next door to the big shop. Dawson had also put all the bits and pieces of motorcycles under cover somewhere, instead of having them strewn around in a handy but unattractive spread. And his pickup was clean. As Dawson slid out of the car, I said, I'm so grateful. I know cars aren't your specialty, and I do appreciate your working on mine.
Repairman to the underworld, that was Trey Dawson.
Well, I did it because I wanted to,
Dawson said, and then he paused.
But if you could see your way to it, I'd sure like it if you'd put in a word for me with your friend Amelia.
I don't have much influence over Amelia, I said, but I'll be glad to tell her what a sterling character you are.
He smiled very broadly. No suppression there. I didn't think I'd ever seen Dawson crack a grin.
She sure looks healthy,
he said, and since I had no idea what Dawson's criteria for admiration were, that was a big clue. You call her up. I'll give a reference, I said.
It's Deal.
We parted happy, and he loped across the newly neat yard to his shop. I didn't know if Dawson would be to Amelia's taste or not, but I'd do my best to persuade her to give him a chance. As I drove home, I listened to the car for any strange noise. It purred away. Amelia and Octavia came in as I was leaving for work. How are you feeling? Amelia said with a knowing air. Fine, I said automatically. Then I understood she thought I hadn't come home the night before. She thought I'd been having a good time with someone. Hey, you remember Trey Dawson, right? You met him at Maria Starr's apartment? Sure. He's going to call you. Be sweet. I left her grinning after me as I got into my car. For once, work was boring and normal. Terry was substituting since Sam hated to work on Sunday afternoons. Merlotz was having a calm day. We opened late on Sunday and we closed early, so I was ready to start home by 7. No one showed up in the parking lot, and I was able to walk directly to my car without being accosted for a long, weird conversation or being attacked. The next morning, I had errands to run in town. I was short on cash, so I drove to the ATM, waving at Tara Thornton Durone. Tara smiled and waved back. Marriage was suiting her, and I hoped she and JB were having a happier time of it than my brother and his wife. As I drove away from the bank, to my astonishment, I spotted Alcide Hervaux coming out of the offices of Sid Matt Lancaster, an ancient and renowned lawyer. I pulled into Sid Matt's parking lot, and Alcide came over to talk to me. I should have driven on, hoping he hadn't noticed me. The conversation was awkward. Alcide had had a lot to deal with, in all fairness. His girlfriend was dead, brutally murdered. Several other members of his pack were also dead. He'd had a huge cover-up to arrange. But he was now the leader of the pack, and he had gotten to celebrate his victory in the traditional way. In hindsight, I suspect he was fairly embarrassed at having sex with a young woman in public, especially so soon after his girlfriend's death. This was quite a bundle of emotions I was reading in his head, and he was flushed when he came to my car window.
Sookie, I haven't had a chance to thank you for all your help that night. It's lucky for us your boss decided to come with you.
Yeah, since you wouldn't have saved my life and he did, I'm glad too. No problem, Alcide, I said, my voice wonderfully even and calm. I was going to have a good day, damn it. Have things settled down in Shreveport?
The police don't seem to have a clue, he said, glancing around to make sure no one else was within hearing distance. They haven't found the site yet, and there's been a lot of rain. We're hoping sooner rather than later they'll cut back on their investigation.
You all still planning the big announcement?
It'll have to be soon. The heads of other packs in the area have been in contact with me. We don't have a meeting of all the leaders like the vampires do, mostly because they have one leader for each state, and we have a hell of a lot of pack leaders. Looks like we'll all elect a representative from the pack leaders, one from each state, and those representatives will go to a national meeting.
That sounds like a step in the right direction.
Also, we might ask other were-animals if they want to come in with us. Like, Sam could belong to my pack in an auxiliary way, though he's not a were. And it would be good if the lone wolves, like Dawson, came to some of the pack parties, came out howling with us or something.
Dawson seems to like his life the way it is, I said, and you'll have to talk to Sam, not me, about whether he wants to associate with you all formally.
Sure. You seem to have a lot of influence with him. Just thought I'd mention it.
I didn't see it that way. Sam had a lot of influence over me, but whether I had any over him, I was dubious. Alcide began making the little shifts in stance that told me as clearly as his brain had that he was about to go his way on whatever business had brought him to Bon Ton. Alcide, I said, seized by an impulse. I do have a question. He said,
sure.
Who's taking care of the Fernan children? He looked at me, then away.
Libby's sister. She's got three of her own, but she said she was glad to take them in. There's enough money for their upbringing. When it comes time for them to go to college, we'll see what we can do for the boy.
For the boy?
He's Pack.
If I'd had a brick in my hand, I wouldn't have minded using it on Alcide. Good God Almighty! I took a deep breath. To give him credit, the sex of the child wasn't the issue at all. It was his pure blood.
There may be enough insurance money for the girl to go, too, Alcide said, since he was no fool. The aunt wasn't too clear about that, but she knows we'll help.
And she knows who we is?
He shook his head. We told her it was a secret society like the Masons that Fernan belonged to.
There didn't seem to be anything left to say. Good luck, I said. He'd already had a fair share of that, no matter what you thought about the two dead women that had been his girlfriends. After all, he himself had survived to achieve his father's goal.
Thank you, and thanks again for your part in that luck. And you're still a friend of the Pack,
he said very seriously. His beautiful green eyes lingered on my face.
And you're one of my favorite women in the world,
he added unexpectedly. That's a real nice compliment, Alcide, I said, and drove away. I was glad I'd talked to him. Alcide had grown up a lot in the past few weeks. All in all, he was changing into a man I admired much more than I had the old one. I'd never forget the blood and the screaming of the horrific night in the abandoned office park in Shreveport, but I began to feel that some good had come out of it. When I returned home, I found that Octavia and Amelia were in the front yard, raking. This was a delightful discovery. I hated raking worse than anything in the world, but if I didn't go over the yard once or twice during the fall, the pine needle buildup was dreadful. I'd been thanking people all day long. I parked in the back and came out the front. Do you bag these up or burn them? Amelia called. Oh, I burn them when there's not a burn ban on, I said. It's so nice of you both to think of doing this. I wasn't aiming to gush, but having your very least favorite chore done for you was really quite a treat.
I need the exercise, Octavia said. We went to the mall in Monroe yesterday, so I did get some walking in.
I thought Amelia treated Octavia more like a grandmother than a teacher. Did Trey call? I asked.
He sure did.
Amelia smiled broadly. He thought you were fine-looking. Octavia laughed.
Amelia, you're a femme fatale.
She looked happy and said, I think he's an interesting guy. A bit older than you, I said, just so she'd know. Amelia shrugged. I don't care. I'm ready to date. I think Pam and I are more buddies than honeys, and since I found that litter of kittens, I'm open for guy business. You really think Bob made a choice? Wouldn't that have been like instinct? I said. Just then, the cat in question wandered across the yard, curious to see why we were all standing out in the open when there was a perfectly good couch and a few beds in the house. Octavia gave a gusty sigh.
Oh, hell,
she muttered. She straightened and held her hands out.
Potestas meate, informam veram tuam, commutabit natura, ipso reaffirmet incantationes praeviae delatae sunt,
she said. The cat blinked up at Octavia. Then it made a peculiar noise, a kind of cry I'd never heard come out of a cat's throat before. Suddenly, the air around him was thick and dense and cloudy and full of sparks. The cat shrieked again. Amelia was staring at the animal with her mouth wide open. Octavia looked resigned and a little sad. The cat writhed on the fading grass, and suddenly it had a human leg. God Almighty! I said, and clapped a hand over my mouth. Now it had two legs, two hairy legs, and then it had a penis, and then it began to be a man all over, shrieking all the while. After a horrible 2 minutes,
the witch Bob Jessup lay on the lawn, shaking all over but entirely human again. After another minute, he stopped shrieking and just twitched. Not an improvement, really, but easier on the eardrums. Then he lunged to his feet, leaped onto Amelia, and made a determined effort to choke her to death. I grabbed his shoulders to pull him off of her, and Octavia said,
"You don't want me to use magic on you again, right?"
That proved a very effective threat. Bob let go of Amelia and stood panting in the cold air.
"I can't believe you did that to me," he said. "I can't believe I spent the last few weeks as a cat."
"How do you feel?" I asked. "Are you weak? Do you need help into the house? Would you like some clothes?" He looked down at himself vaguely. He hadn't worn clothes in a while, but suddenly he turned red, very nearly all over.
"Yes," he said stiffly. "Yes, I would like some clothes."
"Come with me," I said. The dusk was coming on as I led Bob into the house. Bob was a smallish guy, and I thought a pair of my sweats might fit him. No, Amelia was a little taller, and a clothes donation from her would only be fair. I spotted the basket full of folded clothes on the stairs where Amelia had left it to carry up the next time she went to her room. Lo and behold, there was an old blue sweatshirt and a pair of black sweatpants. I handed the clothes to Bob wordlessly, and he pulled them on with trembling fingers. I flipped through the stack and found a pair of socks that were plain white. He sat down on the couch to pull them on. That was as far as I could go toward clothing him. His feet were larger than mine or Amelia's, so shoes were out. Bob wrapped his arms around himself like he feared he was going to disappear. His dark hair was clinging to his skull. He blinked, and I wondered what had happened to his glasses. I hoped Amelia had stored them somewhere. "Bob, can I get you a drink?" I asked.
"Yes, please," he said.
He seemed to be having a bit of trouble getting his mouth to form the words. His hand moved up to his mouth in a curious gesture, and I realized it was just like my cat Tina's movement when she had raised her paw to lick it before she used it to groom herself. Bob realized what he was doing and lowered his hand abruptly. I thought about bringing him milk in a bowl, but decided that would be insulting. I brought him some iced tea instead. He gulped it, but made a face. "Sorry," I said. "I should have asked if you like tea."
"I do like tea," he said,
and stared at the glass as if he'd just connected tea with the liquid he'd had in his mouth.
"I'm just not used to it anymore."
"Okay, I know this is really awful, but I actually opened my mouth to ask him if he wanted some kibble. Amelia had a bag of 9 lives on the back porch shelf. I bit the inside of my mouth hard. "What about a sandwich?" I asked. I had no idea what to talk to Bob about. Mice?
"Sure,"
he said. He didn't seem to know what he wanted to do next. So I made him a peanut butter and jelly and a ham and pickle on whole wheat with mustard. He ate them both, chewing very slowly and carefully. Then he said,
"Excuse me,"
and got up to find the bathroom. He shut the door behind him and stayed in there for a long time. Amelia and Octavia had come in by the time Bob emerged.
"I'm so sorry," Amelia said.
"Me too,"
Octavia said. She looked older and smaller.
"You knew all along how to change him?"
I tried to keep my voice level and non-judgmental. "Your failed attempt was a fraud?" Octavia nodded.
"I was scared if you didn't need me, I wouldn't get to visit anymore. I'd have to go stay all day at my niece's. It's so much nicer here. I would have said something soon, because my conscience was bothering me something awful, especially since I'm living here."
She shook her gray head from side to side.
"I'm a bad woman for letting Bob be a cat for extra days."
Amelia was shocked. Obviously, her teacher's fall from grace was an amazing development to Amelia, clearly overshadowing her own guilt about what she'd done to Bob in the first place. Amelia was definitely a live-in-the-moment kind of person. Bob came out of the bathroom. He marched up to us.
I want to go back to my place in New Orleans, Bob said. Where the hell are we? How did I get here?
Amelia's face lost all its animation. Octavia looked grim. I quietly left the room. It was going to be very unpleasant, the two women telling Bob about Katrina. I didn't want to be around while he tried to process that terrible news on top of everything else he was trying to handle. I wondered where Bob had lived, if his house or apartment was still standing, if his possessions were somehow intact, if his family was alive. I heard Octavia's voice rise.